You're listening to On the Breath, the power of voice in the world. And I'm your host, SJ Harrison. I can't believe that we are at season two of my podcast, and I've really enjoyed diving in deeply with mostly artists that I know during this season two. I also received the feedback that people really enjoyed episode 5 of this season. And in episode 5, I shared more how-tos based on some of the experience of people I know. So we had clips of them talking about something very specific, and then more of a guidance from me about how to use this in your life. So going forward, move the dial a little bit towards how-tos for presentation and public speaking. So we'll still be going deep, but we will also look at how are people needing to use their voice in their business precisely, what's come up for them, and then some advice about how to shift that. I'm sharing with you today the voices and experiences of my partner and of my youngest son. So here you have somebody who's very experienced with speaking. He has always used his voice in his work. He's trained. This is my partner. And he has performed Shakespeare over many, many years and is currently a solopreneur in his native San Francisco. He runs a tour company called SF Expeditions, and he gives private and nearly private tours of this beautiful city and shares his passion for history. We're also going to explore the inner experience of imagery. How do you use imagery in presentation? And what do you do if you have no internal imagery? If you didn't know this existed, you're about to find out. In a moment, we'll hear from my 17-year-old, who is obviously very new to speaking. He's going to share his absolutely worst experience with presenting, and then his best experience, which happened only this week. But before we do that, here's a little story about the power of voice. I'm here with my partner, Paul Jennings, and this also ties into the need to speak. So sometimes when we have a really strong desire to speak, the voice just comes forth.
The early 90s, and I'm doing a gig for San Francisco Shakespeare. They're doing a summer camp. We're in a public park, and we've got 20 kids who are running around, and we're teaching them Shakespeare, and it culminates in a performance of a cut-down version of Love's Labour's Lost. Anyway, this one kid, who's a bit of an oddball, but I really liked him, and picked on by one of the older kids, and we'd sort of stepped in a few times, and finally, after about a week and a half of this, the older kid did something, and it triggered a massive reaction in this kid, and he went full ape mode where he was like, huh, and you know, he attacks the kid. And so now they're rolling around in the dirt. I'm 60, 80 feet away, and I hear this, and I hear the kids yelling up the hill. I see this, and I turn, and before I start to run, I'm kind of panicking because, you know, you don't want the kids to get hurt. And I just went, hey! As loudly as I could. And it was like my feet dug into the ground and I opened my mouth and the ground just kind of shot out. It was both the kids dead. They just stopped what they were doing and turned and looked, and we ran up and broke up the fight and everything was fine. Normally, something of that volume or intensity, I'd have a sore throat or I would kind of have noted that. I'd be like, oh, I'm hoarse. But something about that was so supported in the moment that, I mean, this has stayed with me. It's like 30 years later, and I remember this one instant because it was a fully supported voice being kind of released due to stress.
Here's another thing, however, that I thought of kind of after the fact, which is that one of the times that we breathe very deeply through the mouth and then we immediately make a sound can be when we're in shock or something very immediate happens, as in this situation with Paul. So if you've been listening to me for a while or you're one of my clients, you'll know that I talk a lot about breathing through the mouth and then speaking, because that's actually what we do naturally when we're in flow. Strongly through the mouth, because we need more air to speak than when we're just passive, and breathing through the mouth gives you that just extra load of air. You can take in more, which is why we do it naturally in shock. And though Paul was not in shock, there was an immediacy of needing to act and needing to use his voice. So he breathed in very, very deeply through the mouth and then immediately launched out that sound that he describes. Stress doesn't always, of course, produce a released voice. And we know this for public speaking, how when you're really anxious, it can be really hard to center the voice and your breathing goes haywire. What I think probably happened in this instance is that you're lucky, you naturally have a very loud voice, you've got kind of a barrel chest, and that leads you to have natural vocal production. So if you're thinking of a cathedral, the way that our bodies are shaped, if we know how to use those surfaces that we're bouncing sound off, helped you is that you were really far away and you must have taken an extremely large breath and then pitched your voice at a level to be heard across the space.
Well, at that age, I actually had training. The thing about it was natural. There was no thought to it. It was an emergency situation that called for a big response.
The other thing that we were talking about earlier that I wanted you to share has to do with, you described yourself as quite kinesthetic. When I asked you about how you tend to physicalize when you talk. So Paul physicalizes when he talks. He, even in a natural setting, say there's a few people around and we might all be sitting, it is conceivable that when he's going to tell a story, he will stand up and move around and almost act it out. So he's a naturally very physical person, and that leads into his speaking. And so I wanted to see if you could just talk about what that's like for you, how you may use that when you're going to prepare to speak more intentionally.
Sure. It's not just that I'm sort of kinesthetic and that I feel like I have to move. It's a combination of that and being highly visual. So when I tell a story, I'm recounting it from my perspective. So I will move left to reference something that was on the left, right to reference something on the right, because that's where it's living in the sort of the mental space that I'm recreating. And if you look at things like the ancient art of memory, from the sort of classical art of memory, comes from a translation of Cicero's commentary on a book about the art of memory. We don't have the book that he was commenting on, we just have his notes on it. But one of the things that Cicero the Roman really suggested we use were particularly absurd, bloody, or arresting images. There's some speculation that some of the orators of the ancient world would memorize entire speeches word for word with images for each phrasing or syllables or any method that they may have had. For me, I just use it, the easiest way is if you have a meeting and you have to make 5 points. Okay, 5 bullet points. So you've got a gun with 5 bullets. What's on the first bullet?
Hmm.
And then you make it, it's about introductions. So the first bullet, instead of, you'd have a shell, and instead of the slug, you'd have like a little hand, like shaking hands, introductions.
Mm.
So the first image, and this is just, I'm spitballing this off the top of my head.
That's a great example.
But it's ridiculous, it's weird, it's unusual, and so it stays.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it generally works, is that the unusual, the thing you would remark on, the remarkable, will stay because that's how we work. We see something we've never seen before. We all have images that we've seen, things we wish we could unsee maybe, that stay with us because we had never seen anything like it before.
What do you do if you have no internal imagery? Potentially, none at all. I am here with my son, Ronan. He's in high school, he's 17 years old, and he has a very different experience of visual imagery. So, Ronan, tell us what aphantasia is.
Well, to my understanding, aphantasia is like, it's essentially where you can't visualize images in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it is incredibly difficult to.
How did you find out, what was the process? How did you start realizing the experience I'm having inside my head is different than the people around me?
Well, I was watching this YouTube video of this artist. I don't remember, it was a while ago. But she talked about how she has aphantasia and what it's like, and the fact that she can still be an artist with aphantasia and still imagine things.
So one of the things that started happening around the time that Ronan realized he had aphantasia is, I think for some time, I was trying to help him learn different things, and I would say, oh, picture this in your head, or I was trying to help him focus on a goal, and I'd say, really, really focus on that goal, and he seemed to have a very difficult time doing that, but I didn't know why.
This mainly came to my attention when we were chanting. We have a Buddhist practice, and I would encourage him to focus on a goal and an intention when he was chanting.
Ronan started asking us what we saw in our heads. So he'd say, Mama, when I say think of an apple, what do you see? And does it have a color? And I would describe it in detail. So that, I think, was part of you on your own realizing that this was something you might have.
Well, that was me mainly trying to see if I actually had what I thought I might have had. Like, because I saw that, I was like, wait, that kind of sounds like me.
Right.
I always have trouble imaging anything. I tested it out. I closed my eyes. I did the whole whatever test. And it's very, for me at least, very hard to tell at what stage I'm in, whether I just can't see anything at all. Because it's also still, you could be on the lower end where you just like fuzzy images, but I can't really tell. Simply because I don't know what it's like to not have aphantasia.
Ronan had been looking stuff up online, and he told me there was a test for aphantasia.
So the test for aphantasia, I just sort of just looked up aphantasia test. I just searched up aphantasia in the first place to figure out what it was exactly. And I learned some very interesting things, like that you don't have to be born with it to have it. It can come through very traumatic experiences, whether physically or mentally.
Although, Ronan, my impression is that most people who have it are actually born with it. Is that correct?
I assume that would be the case. But getting back to what I was saying, I was searching these stuff up. I figured out what it was. And I saw a whole bunch of stuff about how it's actually been known about for a really long time. Back then, it was only really described, like, people have found writing or something of it. It's very vague, but only recently are they actually studying it, because before they were aware of this sort of weird thing, but now they're studying it. So then I found the test and I took it, and then I rushed over to you and told you about it, and then what happened?
I think you suggested I take it, and I just assumed, oh, you know, I'm going to come out as neurotypical in this area of imagery. But I actually came out as having hyperphantasia, much to my surprise. Actually, before we go further, I should say hyperphantasia is probably what you think it is, which is that I can see things in extraordinary detail, and in fact, they come immediately and almost unbidden into my head. So when people say things, I see things. And that can help me a lot in my work. But it can also make me very sensitive. So Ronan is aware of that, aren't you? That you can sort of disgust me, or I can go, no, no, that's too much, just by sometimes telling me something.
Right, yeah.
And what was the joke that you made the other day?
I think it was something to do with you stealing all of the imagination from me, all the visible pictures.
Well, you've got lots of imagination, so. But you said something like, because I have hyperphantasia, there was nothing left for you when it came to imagery.
Right.
So what I want to talk about right now is simply, this was a really useful exploration to see how Paul's just been talking about how you can use imagery to remember things and how that really helps him when he's speaking, and it's just a very natural part of who he is because he's visual. And so, of course, because Ronan is my son, I'm also aware that people process things in all kinds of extremely different ways.
With my clients, of course, I really work to find out what works for them. And I encourage you to do this as well. Think about, are you a visual person? How do you already use visuals to connect with the world, to remember things, to impart knowledge to other people? So sometimes when we're telling a story, we see images. What I've realized in being a highly visual person, who's the mother of somebody who is very imaginative and does really great art, but, as he says, does not see images in his head, is that there are many ways in to remembering things and to presenting. It's definitely difficult in some ways when you don't have that imagery. And so for Ronan, he often needs to hear an auditory reminder immediately ahead of time, or write something down, or read something. So if you're a person where your imagery is just not very developed and you become aware, I don't use imagery a lot, for you, cue cards may always be a necessity. You may always need something in front of you so that you know where you are and you can go on to the next thing. Even if you are visual, that's a helpful aid. And there's nothing wrong with doing that as long as you know your material really well and can just talk about it. For example, Ronan was just talking about his experience. So practicing, if you're talking about your experience in a presentation or your area of expertise, whatever the presentation, you can practice talking on that theme. You know your material and then come up with a key phrase that you place on a cue card. This is, of course, where slides are very helpful for people who are presenting as well as for your audience. The main thing with slides is that you don't want to read out what's on the slide. Really, the slide should be adding to the picture. Using a lot of imagery in slides for your audience and even for yourself, right? So if you don't have imagery in your head, you can have the imagery on the slide to cue you in that moment. So using imagery and using key phrases, but not a whole explanation on a slide, is important. So you see that phrase and then you add to it when you're talking to your audience. This is something a lot of people know, but don't practice enough, as well as practice getting up on your feet and talking about it. In my experience, I can't really say this too many times because I do have a lot of people who come to me who confess that they don't practice aloud. They're practicing only in their heads and they're spending a lot of time on writing out the exact details of the material rather than writing out the theme and practicing talking on that theme. That's where you're really going to be using your instrument, because your voice, your body, your breathing, these are all what you engage when you're speaking. It's as if you play the flute, but the only time you actually get up and blow into the flute, as opposed to kind of just going through the motions in your head or the keys with your hands, is in front of people. So that's a good way to think about it. And when we put it in that perspective, it becomes very clear that with presentation, speaking, even preparing for difficult conversations, you need to practice aloud.
I want to talk about my worst experience presenting, and then I'll talk about the recent and best so far. So the worst, we were doing a group project with some people I didn't know.
Ronan was 12 or 13.
I eventually became friends with them, but that's irrelevant. On the day of the presentation, we were going to do it in front of some people from Google, and for a chance to be able to visit, like, Instagram or something like that. I don't remember. So what had happened was my friends, or my now friends, they were sort of panicked, and one of our members didn't come. We didn't have a finished product. And then my friend's parents decided that it was too much for them, and so they just went home. And so I was by myself.
I'm just going to add here that these particular friends of Ronan's, these two who became friends of his, are twins, and that they are on the spectrum. So their parents weren't being oversensitive. They just could really see that their daughters were just really past it at that point.
Yes, and so I was alone for the project, and I was panicking as well when you were there. And so you, so I was going to go up in front of these, essentially, Google judges. And I had an unfinished product. And you tried to help, so you came over not understanding the project and just started making this whole, it was close. But not there.
But no cigar, as but, they say.
Yeah, because you made something about minorities. Because our project was to make an app to help someone in a book who was a minority. But you didn't quite get it. So then you made this thing, and I was just like, I was telling you, you know, like, no, this isn't how it's going to be. And I was like, ah, whatever. And so I went in front of these, like, a whole bunch of people, my entire class, which it was a big class, like three judges or something like that. And I just talked about, I just read what it said. And then the first question the judge says, so how does this relate to this character? And I just said, it doesn't.
Oh, no.
And then they said, okay. And then I just walked off.
Were you frozen with fear in general? Because
I was,
you didn't articulate to me that it had to be, like...
I know, I think I said... no, I didn't articulate. I just said, no, that's not right. I didn't explain. I think I just said
you're
that it wasn't correct.
You're much better explaining now. I'm much better at not overhelping.
But,
I hope.
But I remember that the classmates said my face was as red as... I don't know.
As red can be.
Yeah.
So let's move on to your... great experience, or better
right,
experience
right.
that you had yesterday that I had
well,
the pleasure of witnessing.
Okay, so I have to say, it's 3 a.m. or so. I am being a bad boy and not sleeping. And I have put off finishing a project that I'm working with others to do a slides on how I've done in throughout the school year. And so I'm just about to go, and I said, oh, I should check my text to see if they asked me to do anything. I look, and it's my friend saying that the other partner is worried that I'm not doing work, even though I was almost finished, and they were going to fail, so they just kicked me out of the group, and so they just deleted all my slides, and I was like, oh, no, I have, it's like 3, and tomorrow is the presentation day. And I don't have slides anymore. And so I just panic, and then I cool down, and I just copy over all their slides and just sort of, I erase all the words, I erase everything, all the pictures, except for the ones that they used from me because I took them, so.
Right.
Yeah. And I just kept the same sort of topics, like, okay, this is the presentation, these are the people who did it. So then I did, this is a presentation, these are the people who did it, but I found different pictures. And even during on the day when they saw it, they said, how'd you get those pictures? But basically, around 5, I finished.
Yeah.
And it was, I felt that it was really good. I did a lot of research for it in, like, the majority of the time was panic, so I probably had an hour of just proper focusing and
mm-hmm.
doing it. And then I finished it and was like, okay, well, I'm not going to practice it, so then I just sort of closed it and that was that.
And now for the presentation.
And now for the presentation. Okay, so obviously throughout the day, my group members sort of just kind of looked at me.
Glowered at you.
They kind of glowered at me, yeah, except for my friend, because he's sort of like a neutral kind of person. It's just
Switzerland. Go on.
Okay. And so then they present, and they're a little nervous. Also, I think one of my partner's girlfriends or something was like, okay, Ronan, you finish your slides, and was very smug about everything. It's really weird. I didn't tell you this. Sorry.
No,
yeah.
You didn't. But
because she helped her boyfriend and probably did more than her boyfriend did on the slides.
Uh-huh.
And so they go up, and they're nervous. They're sort of whispering to each other while presenting. I went up right after. And so then I just said it, and I felt like my face was burning up,
mm-hmm.
and I felt really nervous, and yet I was able to speak clearly. There was no tension on my voice at all,
mm-hmm.
I don't think.
Why do you think that was?
I think it was because I felt proud of myself at the time.
Mm.
I think I was like, man, I had an hour of sleep,
mm-hmm.
and I am presenting amazingly.
So it was
I have
personal
really good
best.
Slides.
You had worked hard, and you'd been really dedicated, and you were prepared.
Right.
And that
also
really ties into the importance
also
of preparation.
Also, we were supposed to hand them resumes,
mm-hmm.
and the other group didn't have resumes prepared.
But you'd done it.
But I was a really small adjustment, but I still had it.
Now, it has to be said that Ronan does not always remember these kinds of things, and is not always... What's the word? You struggle sometimes with overwhelm. You definitely struggle with overwhelm.
Right.
Right. And
right.
So this for you was actually a big thing because it's not something that you are always able to do.
Right. I mean, for that moment of time in which I was like, okay, because these slides are, this presentation is actually really important. I'm not sure exactly, but I feel more of like a pass and fail the grade sort of deal.
Right. You have to pass it to
You have
pass
to pass
grade.
It, otherwise you'll have to do a lot more work.
What did you learn from that?
That I can do it, and also
yeah.
I can be, I suppose, I think a great part of this was that my partners, they have this sort of
superiority.
Yes. Well, at least in their minds, because a lot of this stuff is, they've always said that I don't really do anything, I don't really do work, and that's sort of been the sort of theme of this whole year, I think, where a lot of students are saying that I don't do work at all. But that was mainly because of, you know, like Zoe dying, our cat, and stuff.
And there were some other stresses at school that were really intense that nobody knew about. And so you
right.
were going through an awful lot and not actually living up to what you've done in the past, which is you've usually been a really good group partner.
Right, yeah. And
so you probably felt like you weren't really being seen.
Uh-huh. And also, I think, just feeling good about myself. That was essentially the whole reason why I was able to speak confident, because I felt good.
And I think...
And I felt proud.
Which is great, because you were able to perform well, even when there were people there who weren't really wishing you well. And that's an That's a pretty extraordinary accomplishment.
Right, and also, one of my biggest worries was that since I didn't get a lot of sleep, that I wasn't going to be able to fully articulate, because that is sort of what was going on through the day. I wasn't able to think properly, I wasn't
mm-hmm.
able to talk. But then it felt like I just got like a full night's sleep all of a sudden.
And
yeah.
We call that Dr. Theater.
So that phrase is probably highly self-explanatory, and it refers to the actor's experience of going on stage when you're sick, thinking you're not going to be able to get your voice out, and that you can't possibly go on, and yet you can, and you give a great performance, and nobody can tell the difference. So I think that's definitely got something to do with focus and adrenaline, and again, we can do a lot when we feel that we really want to. Earlier in the podcast, of course, we were talking about imagery and when you don't have imagery and the different techniques you can use for presenting, whether using imagery or focusing mainly on cue cards, for example. In my online self-study program, there is an entire module which teaches you how to use something that I call the memory palace technique. And this is drawing from the content that Paul was introducing us to earlier around how to use imagery and even place that imagery in a familiar space in order to learn content for a speech. That program is called Empower Your Voice, and I've designed it both in terms of price and availability to be really easy for people to use globally. So do check that out, as well as some of the free resources that I have. All of that information is in the notes below. Enjoy your summer. This podcast will be back with you on August 7th. And please do reach out to me if you know someone who you think must be on this podcast. I'm SJ Harrison, and this has been On the Breath. You can find the podcast on my website, sjharrisoncoach.com, as well as other major streaming platforms. On the Breath is also on my Substack, The Speakeasy Extra. I invite you to subscribe there, and leaving a comment or review helps people like you find me. If you're needing some support, my free class is a great place to start. All these resources are in the notes. Thanks for listening.